I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. We hear these questions every June. What are you going to do with your degree? And what's your dream job? My next guest doesn't give the expected answer. UW junior Deb Kwan just wrote a piece in the University of Washington Daily called "The Grueling Labor Wet Dreams of Capitalism, Graduates Diverging from Conventional Career Paths." Deb, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, glad to be here.
You bring an interesting perspective here. You are a business major. What do you think most people expect when they ask you what you're going to do with your life?
I think a lot of people ask me, or not ask me, they expect me to say something like, oh, I'm going to go work for Amazon or Google, or maybe venture into a startup or something, or like, you know, try to like get into a consulting firm or something. I think that's a pretty typical answer for someone like in my position right now.
And yeah, so it's not just a typical question, but would that be the standard answer among your fellow UW business majors?
I think so. I think that's pretty standard from what I've seen.
And why does that not draw you, Deb?
I don't know. I think that for me, it's just something that it doesn't, I guess, spark something in me. I think that partly I feel like I've gotten to do a lot more reflection about myself and my future over the course of the pandemic since we've all been indoors and kind of just like, you know, we're kind of just sort of have been like stuck inside thinking about a lot of things and reflecting probably about ourselves and our lives, especially like, you know, being in college and really like in my like first stages of adulthood. I have been thinking a lot more about like what exactly it is I want to do after I graduate and what I want my future to look like. And me being a business major, it is very much sort of like a, you know, you can find lucrative job paths, you can make money, but I feel like the stuff that I'd be doing isn't something that really, I guess I find a passion in, you know. I think that where I'm at, there's, like, if I were to stick with a pretty traditional standard path, as I talked about, like, with your previous question, I could probably, like, make money and I could financially support myself, but I don't necessarily know if I'll wholly enjoy what I'm doing, and that sort of has me wanting to diverge from the standard path.
Yeah, you're a drama minor. How does that figure into what you do want to do?
Yeah, so me being a drama minor is kind of like, I guess, me trying to find a way with, you know, what I'm studying, my academics, to kind of like put in some of the stuff I enjoy more in there. Because, you know, I am a business major, so like, you know, during the quarter, I take my, usually I will take a couple of courses for my degree, my business degree, and then I'll add in like one or two more interesting classes. Maybe it'll be a drama class, or maybe it'll be some other, like, you know, elective. And doing the drama minor is kind of, for me, a way to kind of put in my interests, you know, with acting, with theater, with, like, you know, creative storytelling and everything, even if it's not necessarily the focus. Because I do see that currently, I don't think my career path totally is, you know, going in that drama, theater, whatever direction. But I think it's something I still want to be a part of my life, even if it's not the main focus, at least in like the future I see for myself at the moment. And so I guess it's just kind of a way for me to maybe have that existing in my life. Maybe it'll be incorporated in like a future career path, but I feel like at the moment it doesn't really factor much into like what I'll be doing like work-wise, but it's mostly kind of just a thing that's like I want it to like exist in my life at least, so I'm trying to, you know, at least have some like side focus on it, as at least through my like academic experience as an undergraduate.
Well, you're asking questions that I was asking myself when I was a University of Washington student. And and a lot of people are hearing those questions, especially at around graduation time. I know you're a UW junior. Why did you write this piece in the Daily, the student newspaper, about this question? What are you going to do and what's your dream job?
I think it's because, so it's like, you know, I was writing this for the Daily Special Graduation Edition in June. And like we talked about, I am a drama minor, and so this means that I am pretty like involved as much as I can be over the course of the pandemic with, you know, the theater community on the UW campus. And so I am surrounded by a good chunk of people who want to work in the arts in some capacity. They want to do theater in the local Seattle area, or maybe they want to move to like LA or New York, and you know, you like chase your dreams and like act in like film and stuff. And so, like, those are examples. And so I just like, I feel like I've been thinking a lot about that, because I know as a business major, I'm around a lot of people, you know, they want to work in tech companies, they want to work in corporate settings, and that's what they're planning to do after graduating. But then I'm also in a different sphere of people that are not really into that, and they definitely want to take the plunge into, like, acting in theater, working behind the scenes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, I think that kind of also just resonated to my own perspective about work and, like, what exactly is it I want to do, and the reflections I've been having over the past year, I guess years, perhaps. And so I kind of just wanted to explore that, talk to some of these people who want to pursue different paths in intersection with kind of like how I've been feeling about, you know, career paths and everything. And I kind of just wanted to give a spotlight to those perspectives and my own perspective for this special edition at The Daily.
Well, your essay is getting at some of the assumptions behind the question, what is your dream job, and the assumptions behind capitalism. What do you think of even that question of what is your dream job? Do you dream about your job? Do you dream about work?
I don't think I do. I mean, I don't think that there's ever going to be a world that doesn't have work, you know, because I think that'll always be necessary regardless. But I do think that the way we grow up and the way things are, like at least in the U.S., is that one of the like earliest questions you ask, you get asked. Well, I don't say that. I won't say it's one of the earliest questions, but very commonly you get asked, you know, even as a kid, like, oh, what's your dream job? What do you want to be when you grow up? And then like in high school, you get asked that, like, oh, what do you think you're going to major in? Oh, what do you want to do when you grow up? And then like college graduates are asked, oh, what are your plans now since you're graduating? What's that going to look like? So it's like, I feel like the emphasis of work is highly embedded in, I guess, just like our society, our world. And I think it's just like a very big focus on it. Like, I think work is important, but also I feel like there is a very big focus on it. And it's like, oh, work is what matters. This is what you need to like make money. Sometimes there's a lot of portrayals of like, oh, work isn't supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be something that's hard. It's supposed to be something that's stressful. And I think like, so we have these sort of negative attitudes towards work, I guess, as a generalization. And I think that just adds to like these questions about asking like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? What's your job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Aren't super fun. And I think that like, it's just like kind of, it's compounded with the way we portray work and stuff. It's like, I think work could be enjoyable, but I think it's hard to be made enjoyable because of the way it's set up in like our world, I guess. And I guess thinking about capitalism and how, you know, a lot of us, a big portion of people here have to work to survive. And so when you're kind of doing that survival work, it's hard to enjoy it. So maybe people might have dream jobs that maybe it could be something that people enjoy, you know, because like people want to do the arts, people want to work in journalism, people want to do the things they enjoy for a living. But a lot of times, like one that might not always be possible, we do call it a dream job. And I sometimes feel like dream implies that it might not totally happen. And it's just something you're going to like kind of be grasping for, but not getting. And I feel like the other thing is just that with all these questions that were being asked and with this emphasis of like, what's your dream job? What do you want to do when you grow up and everything? It's just like a really big focus on work. And like I said, work is always going to exist, but I think that there is more that life offers and we shouldn't be so focused on that. And I think that adds to maybe the discomfort that people have when we think about jobs, when we think about our futures, and we kind of just groan or being like, ugh, I don't want to think about that. And I think that kind of just all adds up to like these ideas, or I guess it all just kind of like snowballs into these ideas of like why maybe the job question isn't so fun and like the role of work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah.
Finally, Deb, has your fellow student, would you say your fellow students' attitudes toward work and career have changed through the pandemic, the racial justice protests? Has this last year, do you think, made that question and the answers any different?
I think that definitely it's had an impact. And I'm thinking, like, specifically, I can't speak for everyone, but I think the people I've been around in my age cohort, you know, from, like, 18 to the early 20s, people who are in college, I think people definitely have, like, sort of changed their attitudes because, like I said about myself earlier, I've done a lot of reflecting about what my future is going to look like, what I want to do after I graduate. And I think a lot more people have been doing that. Because I think, like, in general, like, if you're in, like, during the lockdown isolation period and everything, you kind of just with yourself and your thoughts, and you think a lot more about that. And I think a lot more people, especially with, like, the impacts of, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and, like, people, the, like, social issues entering, like, the public conscious a little bit more, people are thinking more about these issues. And I think especially, like, young people like myself are thinking about, oh, maybe things can be different. Maybe we don't necessarily have to go down the paths that, you know, are, like, not so fun, or that kind of, like, you're like, oh, I'll do it because I need to make money. And, you know, if you don't have money, you can't really, like, meet your basic needs and more. So I feel like a lot more people are thinking about that, as well as maybe the more exploitative parts of work and that make it not so fun and everything. And I think that a lot more people that in my age cohort are thinking more broadly and trying to push boundaries on what that could look like. And I do think that as a result of even just like literally the last year or last months have had an impact on that, because I think a lot of us are just thinking about it all a lot more and wanting to make things look different or maybe live different lives than we might have thought before all of these like big changes and big questions have appeared in our minds because of like the pandemic, being inside, you know, social movements, et cetera, et cetera.
University of Washington junior Deb Kwan wrote an article for the UW Daily headlined "The Grueling Labor Wet Dreams of Capitalism, Graduates Diverging from Conventional Career Paths," which you can find at dailyuw.com. Deb, thanks for talking with us today. Have a good summer, too.
Yeah, thank you.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back. The Biden administration is gradually reuniting families separated at the Mexico border under President Trump. My next guest says watching those reunions takes her back to the first time she saw her own parents after a five-year separation. Judy Temes was a five-year-old living in Hungary when her family left the country without her, gambling that one day they would be reunited. Her new memoir is called Girl Left Behind.
In 1969, borders were sealed. It was the height of the Cold War. My parents, and especially my father, really wanted to leave the country, leave Hungary. Mm-hmm. And there really was no way to do it legally. So the one way that he found was through these tourist visas that allowed him to, and with my mother and my brother, to come, to go to a Western country, to a free country. In this case, it was Vienna. And the catch was to get these visas, one member of your immediate family had to be left behind.
So that they would think it was a vacation and not a departure from Hungary?
Exactly. And some people, like if you were a high-level party official, a whole family could go, but not ordinarily. And for my father, who was an outspoken critic of the government, he was not going to get those visas. So that's how I was left when my parents made that incredibly difficult decision. I thought that my family was going on a vacation, that they would be gone for a couple of weeks, and then they would all return and we'd go back to life as usual. And I, in fact, didn't know for months on end. Weeks and weeks went by, and I found myself still at my grandmother's house, and children are going back to school, and I'm wondering what's going on. But I really did not know, and I didn't learn until almost 5-6 months later that this was not a vacation, that in fact they were moving to America.
And what did you understand about why you weren't with them?
You know, it really actually wasn't even explained, to be honest. There was no real explanation. I mean, in those days, I think children were not talked to in the way that we talk to our children today with explanations. And at first I was just told, they're coming back. Any week now they're coming home. And once my grandmother finally sat me down about 4 or 5 months into this, she basically went right to, and eventually you're going to go to America with them. And she painted this glorious picture of how wonderful it's going to be. And to me, that's all I heard. I didn't hear that, you know, that why I'm not there, or why, what they were seeking, or why they chose to go. All I knew is that eventually I'm going to go, and it's going to be this incredible paradise. And I had no idea that, you know, none of us actually knew how long it would take.
Yes, your family thought maybe it would be a year. Again, the book is Girl Left Behind by Judy Temis, now of Seattle. Judy, why did it take 5 years for you to be reunified?
I think there was an element of punishment against my parents, and the government at that time saw them as traitors. In fact, shortly after they left, we had police coming into our apartment. They came and rummaging through the home. They took things like our piano. So they could do it. So they weren't going to allow me to go.
Judy, the book largely is about how you gradually came to live with what was going on. How did you make sense of that as a little girl and growing up through it?
I think there was always that dream that eventually this day will come. And I had, and my grandmother, I was left with my grandmother in her care, and she was an incredible person. If you can just picture her, she's this typical Eastern European, maybe Russian babushka lady with her. She had no teeth. She had a black frock. She wore these shoes that were so worn down at the heel, but she had a heart of gold. And every day she took care of me, and she helped me kind of get through this experience and kept that dream alive for me all those years. So I went to school and I had a fairly normal life. In fact, in some ways it was wonderful because, well, I shouldn't say wonderful. It was interesting because the kids at school knew that I was going to America, Juditka, and that I was special because of that. And I had this little status in the school, in the schoolyard.
Yeah, you and the kids would pretend to be on a plane going fancy places.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was all part of the dream, you know, like we, at that time, 1970s, we were somehow getting illegal television from on a channel from Austria, actually, and we could watch television shows, and I was watching, and we had an idea of what America would be like, and we kind of played with our imagination a little bit with that. But it was also, you know, very sad because, you know, when as a child you don't have your mother and you have a broken arm or you get sick, and those are the times when you are just longing for your mother and she's not there. And no one can take that place. Those were some very, very sad moments too.
Yeah, there were, as you said, there was a lot of love there. There was also a lot of deprivation. You describe your elderly grandmother shoveling the coal and hauling the water, doing it
right.
All.
It was a house, if you can imagine, in 1970, a house with no running water, a well outside where she had to bend down literally on her knees to pull this water up with a frayed rope. This she had to do this day in and day out just to like heat up water for washing or make tea or cook. And it was in many ways a very difficult and very different life than what I had as a little child with my parents, who were both physicians, who had a comfortable home. And to go into this deprived little village was hard. And it was hard for me to just even absorb that, to see my grandmother in this kind of life.
The book is a memoir, Girl Left Behind. Judy Temes is now a teacher in Seattle, grew up in authoritarian Hungary. I hope you don't mind if we give away that you made it back, because I do want to talk about not just your separation, but your reunification.
Yes. So the people I was living with really were not able to understand the system very well. But I did have a relative, and my mother eventually reached out to him to help. And he did a lot of the intervening of going to the capital city and getting papers signed and pursued that. And he was truly my fairy godfather and my fairy godmother, his wife, who really rescued me from that situation. And eventually the Cold War thawed, and there was a congressman in the Bronx who made it his business to look after this. And it just goes to show you that our politicians can do these wonderful things. And had he not done that, I don't know what would have happened. But he reached out to the Hungarian government and he said, we are going to reunite this family. And he made that happen, which is extraordinary. And I have this memory, and I was 10 years old, and when we were finally reunited, he came to our home, and he actually, they took some pictures, and some the news came, and I got to practice these words in English, thank you very much to the United States of America. So that was an incredible moment in my life.
But when you finally made it to New York, it was kind of sad, and it was kind of awkward meeting your family all over again.
Yes, and that's why when I see these kids who are being reunited now with their parents, I kind of feel like what that must be like. Because when they leave you, you're like this little 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 5-year-old, you're this, you know, little kid, and then you come and you're this awkward stage of life. And seeing my parents for the first time, and it was something that I longed for. I looked forward to it all those years. And it's something that my mother kept promising would happen in these annual Christmas letters that she would write to me. And finally, here are these people in front of me at the airport, and I know that they are my family, and yet I don't know them. They're strangers. I mean, I have not lived with them. I don't know who they are. And I feel for these kids because they're going to go through those same types of experiences, having to get to know their families all over again. And that will take time. And it took some time for me as well to get comfortable with that and to get comfortable with them as my parents.
How did you come to understand, as you could talk to your parents and just grow up, how did you really come to understand that decision? I mean, the choice that your parents had made and why they did that and what they were aware of as far as the pain that you went through. How did you come to understand all this?
Yeah, so my mother explained to me the story with the visas and how they were able to do it, and that this was one of the few ways that they could do it. I also knew from my father's background and his story, I knew him to be an opinionated, strong, outspoken man. What she told me is that she was really worried about him being imprisoned at some point because of his speaking out against the government, or that his mental health would fail and that he just wouldn't be able to like continue to live in that place. And one of the reasons for that is not just that he's living under this totalitarian regime, but it's also the legacy of the Holocaust. My father was a Jew, and he lost his entire family to Auschwitz, with the exception of his half-brother. He and his half-brother survived. So he could just no longer tolerate living in that country with the memories that he had in that same town, actually, not even the country, but the same very town where he grew up, where his entire family was taken from. So that drove his decision very much. And I understood that over time. My father never wanted to talk about these things. You know, for him, it was, we are in America. This is our future. We somehow made this work and we're just going forward. But my mother and I talked about these things and I learned a story from her. And I eventually, as my mother grew older, she came to live with me. And one of the most beautiful things in my life was coming full circle with her. My children were all living at home at that point. They're all grown up now. And for her to be in their presence and to be a part of our lives really helped the two of us forgive and move on, and not even move on, but just to heal. And she said something very difficult to me at one point. We were having this conversation and I asked her, Mom, how could you make this decision? Because here I am, I'm a mother of three children. There is absolutely no way that I could make this decision that she did. How could you make this decision? And she broke down and she cried and tears were coming down her face. And remember, she's old now, she's in her 80s. She said to me, I was a coward. And I was just like blown away by those words. I was like, and I said to myself, that's not true. She wasn't, you know, she did a really brave things in many ways. And it's an incredibly hard thing, but it was something I think she had to say and maybe admit, because there's truth to it inside that there is a truth. And yeah, there was a lot of, I think that was important for both of us to say that out loud, to hear it, and for me to actually forgive her for it, because it's such a hard decision. I think it was much harder for my mother than for my father, because for him, this was like, we're moving forward and we're going to the promised land. I mean, that's what he kept saying. And for my mother, who was a very much beloved pediatrician in our town, for her to leave the life that she left and to leave her only daughter, it was I can't even fathom a decision like that.
Well, Judy, could you forgive your father for being much more willing, I guess, or accepting of the idea of leaving little Yudhitka behind?
You know, knowing his story, knowing what he went through as a survivor, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Not even a doubt, not even a question. And I think in some ways we're so lucky to have, you know, it worked out in the end. He took this incredible gamble that, you know, maybe if we do this, we can all get to America. And it was a huge gamble. Not unlike the gamble that people are taking still today to get to this country. It's still going on. It's still happening. Parents are making enormous sacrifices, often leaving their children behind if they must. But we have to forgive. I mean, we're so lucky, you know, to live in this country. And I'm grateful for that. And yes, forgiveness is there.
I want to ask you about that too. You are a middle school history teacher now. You grew up in an authoritarian country.
Yes.
And lost your family through that. And today, Hungary again has an authoritarian leader. Do you teach your students about this stuff?
I absolutely do. I teach American history. And we talked so much this year about the elections and about what it means to have a democracy. And sometimes I get pushback from my students and they say, Mrs. Temes, we are kids. Why do we need to know about these politics? And I say, you know, if you don't know about politics, politics will happen to you. We have a precious democracy in this country and it's not a given that it survives. We have to protect it with everything we have. And we have to be active citizens. And I talk to them about, you know, the importance of voting and the importance of being involved, the importance of educating yourself, of reading and listening, making critical decisions for yourself. And it makes me so sad to see my country, Hungary. I mean, they had the chance to have a liberal democracy after communism fell. And indeed, it's a very scary country right now, one of a handful right now in Europe that are leaning in that direction. And it's so sad to see human rights being, you know, violated. I think there's just some new things going on against people, LGBTQ people, that's just happening right now. There's fences going up to keep people out this time, to not allow people into the country. There is no independent press right now in Hungary. There is no independent judiciary. So I teach my kids that all this is precious and we have to hold on to it and protect it.
Again, the new memoir is called Girl Left Behind, and that little girl from Hungary is Judy Temes, now of Seattle. Judy, thank you so much for telling us your story.
Bill, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate being able to share my story with you. Thank you.
We're going to talk dating in 2021. Stay tuned. Get some end now, let your edge out. Touch some iceberg, you'll be heavy in my mind. Can you get the heck out? I need rest now, got me bummed out. You, baby. How are your social skills after a year plus of pandemic? My next guest says if you're ready to date but are feeling socially rusty, she's here to help with a July 10th event she calls the Not Creepy Gathering for people who want to fall in love. Jenna Bean Veach, welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Good to talk with you again. We're going to open up the phones now, too. Listeners, what has been your dating experience in the pandemic? Please give us a call right now. The number is 206-543-KUOW. I know you have a story. Tell us a dating challenge, or if you made a surprising connection this year or so, help everyone else out. Tell us how. Good or bad, tell us a dating story now. The phone number is 206-543-KUOW, which is 543-5869. Jenna, what is the Not Creepy Gathering for people who want to fall in love?
Yeah, it is very much a structured event designed to help people find connection. I've been doing them for 6 years now, first as in-person events, of course, and then in the pandemic, we shifted them to the virtual realm, and we are about to do our first in-person event in 15 months. On July 10th.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about what's interesting about that shift and everything we've been through. But tell us more about what happens at this structured event.
Yeah. So there are some all group things that we'll do together. There are a number of small group conversations where I'll put people into a group of, say, four people and give them a question to answer with their group and a few minutes to talk. I think I shared last time I spoke with you, I often start with my favorite question, which a 10-year-old once asked me, which is, what's your favorite feeling? And I love that question because it's something most people haven't thought about, but it actually tells you a lot about a person. And I tend to seek out those sorts of quirky questions that get at something real. And now I'm really asking questions that feel relevant to this moment. So I might early on ask something like, what book, movie, TV show, podcast would you recommend for this moment and why? And then as we progress and as we are ready to go a little deeper, we might get to something like, what's been surprisingly hard about the last 15 months and what's been surprisingly good?
Yeah. And this is your first event back since the pandemic, but have you already been gathering answers to that? What's the most common answer to that question about what's been hard or what's been good about pandemic dating?
Yeah, especially people who come to these events, people who are wanting to find love or wanting to find connection. The isolation, I think, is the most common answer I've heard to what's been surprisingly hard. I think many of us have experienced that in some way, but it seems like, in particular, people who are maybe unpartnered have been feeling that really acutely.
Yeah. Again, let me just give out the phone number and then ask you about that. If you want to share a dating story, a dating success, a dating challenge, maybe you relate to this isolation thing that Jenna just said. How have you handled that isolation? Here's our phone number, area code 206-543-KUOW. Again, 543-5869. So isolation, that can mean a lot of things. I mean, people do... They talk online, or they talk by phone, or they have gotten together in person but distanced, maybe outside, mm-hmm. maybe in a mask, et cetera, et cetera. So what's been most interesting about how people have handled that isolation?
Yeah. You know, it has been challenging for a lot of people. But it's also... given us a lot of time for reflection. I'm hearing from so many people that they have gotten some clarity about what it is they really want. And now is this amazing moment where we get to apply those reflections. We can finally start meeting strangers again. We can start meeting new people. So this is through the Fremont Abbey at the Ballard Homestead, their Ballard space. And I had a conversation with them months ago when they were just imagining this moment of reopening. They decided pretty early on in the pandemic that when they reopened, they weren't going to just go back to doing what they were doing before the way they were doing it before. If we have to rebuild everything anyways, we might as well build some new things. And it was inspiring and encouraging me for me to hear that this one organization I work with is approaching this moment as an opportunity. And I feel like we all have that opportunity. That is true for us as individuals. We've had time to reflect on what we do and what we want and how we do things and how we live our lives. And we're emerging now. It can be true on organizational levels, on cultural levels. We are certainly in that moment, in this period of racial reckoning. This is the moment when we get to think about building new things in our own lives and on a large scale.
We're talking about dating during the pandemic. Maybe you're in some stage of coming out of the pandemic, and there's an event July 10th at the Ballard Homestead called the Not Creepy Gathering for People Who Want to Fall in Love. And the organizer's been doing this for a while, for a few years now, and she's back in person. Jenna Bean Veach is my guest, and we have our first phone call. Again, our phone line is open, area code 206-543-KUOW. That's 543-5869, so that you can call and give us your experience, what you've been doing or not doing. You don't have to date. You know, what have you been doing or not doing, success, challenges during the pandemic? We're at 543-KUOW. Our first call is from, is it Samos in Edmonds?
It is Samos.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill.
What's been your experience? Hi.
Well, a couple things. I went to the Not Creepy thing. I think it has a long title. I don't remember the whole thing. But
mm-hmm. The Not Creepy Gathering for People Who Want to Fall in Love.
That's it. And that was me. So I was trying to do that. And I had been doing online dating and not having a lot of luck with that. So I went to that, and that was a lot of fun. I didn't find a love there, but I did find a couple friends that I've actually stayed in touch with. And one of them I've gone out with a few times just for fun. So that was great. And then, but I did actually find my love throughout, in the middle of the pandemic. And it was last September, and I'm a critical care nurse, so I was in the heart of all the trouble with COVID, and I got COVID myself and caring for my patients. And so oddly enough, one of my selling factors was that I had antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had gone through a full case of COVID, and I was like, in my profile, I was like, hey, you could actually meet me in person and we could actually have a date. And so that's what we did. And we went to the beautiful Cascadia Art Museum, which is up in Edmonds here, which everybody should take the time to come up and see. And we had a wonderful time and have fallen in love and do all kinds of wonderful things together. And that's my happy story.
Mm. Jenny, got a reaction or a question?
Story. Yeah, I love hearing that happy story. And yeah, what a great advantage you got to bring to the table.
Was it just like
right.
dating because you had antibodies, but was it therefore just like dating any other time, or was there a pandemic dynamic to your dating?
Well, there was a pandemic dynamic. Someone somewhere said that that time spent together with someone during the pandemic was equal to something like two or three times the amount of time you would have had together in the before times. So we laugh about that. We figure we've actually had a bit of a condensed version. We saw each other quite a lot. We did go to restaurants as soon as they were available to go to, which was a little bit sooner up here in Snohomish than it was in Seattle, but also in Seattle. And I've lived for decades in the Seattle area and Capitol Hill and things. So as I could, I've taken her around to see all the good parts of Seattle, and a lot, a bit pathetic, looking at things from the outside and saying, oh, that place that used to be there was so great, and
yeah.
things like that. But but we did spend a lot of time together and got together quite quick. I remember some of our first dates were actually at Duke's at Green Lake and walking around the lake. So,
mm-hmm. Well, Samus, it sounds like you want this one to stick. So good luck to both of you. And thanks a lot for calling in today.
Yeah, thanks Samus.
And we're talking with my guest who's organizing this gathering here in a few weeks in July, Jenna Bean Veach, the Not Creepy Gathering for People Who Want to Fall in Love. What are you doing about antibodies? Are you vaccinated? Vaccination certificates, masks?
Yep.
How are you spacing? How are you handling that at this event July
10th? Yep, good question. We thought a lot about how to approach that. And we are going to require proof of full vaccination for anyone entering. Because vaccinations will be required, masks will be optional. And because I really want this to be accessible to everyone, and people have a variety of reasons for not getting vaccinated, we've added another virtual event on July 11th.
Got it. Let's take another call from Dee Dee this time, who I think is in West Seattle. Dee Dee, what's been your pandemic, maybe-ish post-pandemic dating experience?
Yeah, I was with a man for around 3 years who sort of horrifically betrayed me last summer. And what I found then, as because of the pandemic, I wasn't seeing and hugging my girlfriends, I wasn't seeing my grandchildren, but I got touch hunger with the isolation because no one was touching me. I wasn't touching anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did some dating, which was weird because, you're masked and you're distanced and who is this person? It's hard enough to figure that out when people are sitting next to you in a restaurant.
Yeah.
So, but that betrayal really bummed me out. And I ended up doing some traveling to kind of shake it off. But travel was pretty difficult at that time. This was like October and November of 2020. And I went to New York hoping to see some friends, but my friends wouldn't see me, even masked and distanced, so because they were very worried about the virus. So I still had a good time, but most of New York City was closed down still. So I did get to go to the Metropolitan Museum, which was fantastic. But
yeah, any reaction or question, Jenna?
Yeah, just that I've actually heard from a lot of people whose relationships did not survive the pandemic.
Uh-huh.
All of that sudden concentrated time together was too much for a lot of people. And so I've actually talked to quite a few people who became single during the pandemic and really as a result of.
Well, I don't think this was that. This man had, over the 3 years, gradually revealed himself to be a sociopath who was completely incapable of being faithful, and had a bunch of people on the side that I had no idea about, and then decided that I was too depressive a person for him to hang out with any longer, because we're both old. I'm 71, he was 69 at the time. Then he didn't think I would be healthy enough to take care of him when he got older and sicker. Mm-hmm. And so he dumped me for one of the numerous others. And so that, I'm afraid that was not pandemic related.
Yes.
That was personality related.
I'm,
right.
I'm so sorry you had that experience.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I'm so sorry you had that experience. And also, congratulations on being out of that relationship. It sounds like that was not a good person for you to be with.
Dee Dee, thank you.
Hallelujah. Yep,
hallelujah. Thank you for sharing your experience. Thank you, Dee Dee. We're talking, and by the way, the phone number again, 206-543-KUOW. That's 543-5869. We're getting your stories, your reactions to what dating has been like during the pandemic. And we're talking with Jenna Bean Veach, the founder and organizer of the Not Creepy Gathering for people who want to fall in love. Their first in-person event in more than a year is July 10th at the Ballard Homestead. Why we talked about this the last time you and I spoke, Jenna, but that's an attention-getting title. What's creepy about people wanting to fall in love? What do you mean not creepy compared to what?
I think, unfortunately, when people are trying to date or trying to find connection, they can end up encountering a lot of creepiness. And by creepiness, I mean meeting people who objectify them, see them just as a body rather than as a whole person. We are people with our own longings and fears and histories and hearts. Creepy also means not caring about or not respecting somebody's boundaries. And by putting it in the title, we get to identify this as a different space, as a space that is both safe and non-judgmental, in which we get to really honor each person who shows up because they were brave enough to show up.
And Jenna, who is welcome here? How are you welcoming toward people of all kinds of orientations and backgrounds, races, cultures, gender orientations? How are you doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's really important to me that we don't assume somebody's orientation or gender identity. We have a name tag system where people put on their name tags not just their name, but a way to identify who they are and who it is they're looking for. There are still, it's shocking to me, but still heterosexuality is assumed in many dating spaces, and I have no interest in doing that or in creating a straight specific space. And I do get a really wide range of people. I will say that often, not always, often I end up with more women than men or non-binary folks. I will just put out a call right now. If you are a male-identified person who is willing to let yourself be just a little bit vulnerable, who's willing to say, yes, I actually do want to fall in love, we need you. Please come.
Jenna Bean Veach, founder and organizer of the Not Creepy Gathering for people who want to fall in love. And she's been doing this for a few years now and starts with an icebreaker and has ways of trying to get past some of those, the shallowness, the judgment, and just the discomfort, especially coming out of this pandemic, if that's what you're able to do now. Jenna, that first person event in more than a year is July 10th at the Ballard Homestead. And thanks for just getting us back comfortable with the idea of dating again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And July 17th, we've added a date.
July 17th as well. Good to talk with you again, Jenna.
Yeah, thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW, produced by Jenny Cecil Moore, Alec Cowan, Brandy Fullwood, and Sarah Leibovitz. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll see you again tomorrow.